I'll just give you a little bit of background, first of all, of what this is about. So I've been teaching Talmud in my house for a couple of years, and what we've been doing is basically looking at how the Talmud deals with different topics, from everything from abortion to gun control to women's issues, etc. And I decided this year I wanted to do something new, which is really just go through the Talmud itself slowly and in English. Excuse me. And that's what this thing has been. So I've been doing this. I've had 8 sessions already. So I know David's been in more than one of the most recent ones. Judy, you have not. So this is kind of a whole background as to what Talmud is and how it works and so on. Judy, do you have any background?
A little bit. I have taken Talmud classes, but I've never studied consistently.
Okay. So just since it's the three of us, if you know this material, you can say move on, or you want to stop and talk about something, please. It's supposed to be interactive. So what I'm going to start with, because I'm a very big history fan, is basically the background. What is the Talmud? Where does it come from? How do we have it? So the start, of course, is it comes from Mount Sinai. And on Mount Sinai, according to Jewish tradition, God gave Moses something. And the something is not always clear, but we pretty much agree it's the written Torah, which is the 5 books of Moses that we read in Shul. But there's also a tradition that at the same time, God gave us an oral Torah, which was a commentary, a legal extract of laws that base from the written Torah. So what is the written Torah? The oral Torah, I'm sorry. So the oral Torah was written down. Now, the Mount Sinai is around 1250 BCE. The oral Torah was written down into a book called the Mishnah, starting in the year zero, and it lasted for 200 years until it was finally written. And that work is called the Mishnah, and Mishnah basically means teaching. I will tell you now, I'm very big on words and what words mean because that always helps me. So the Mishnah was compiled in the land of Israel by the group called the rabbis. It took 200 years till they finished doing that, compiling, editing, redacting. And when that effort finished, they started commenting on it. And the commenting on the Mishnah is called the Gemara, which not surprisingly means teaching. And what the Gemara consists of, and I think I'm going to do more of this in a moment, is the commentary on the Mishnah. And the Mishnah and the Gemara together make up what we call the Talmud. And the word Talmud itself means teaching. So everything is teaching. Okay. Now, let's talk about that in more context. So here we have a history of the period. And forgive me if I'm a little rusty on this because I haven't seen it in a bit. But as I said, the Mishnah was compiled from roughly the year 0 to 200. And in between, we had the destruction of the Second Temple, which is in the year 70, which was, of course, a landmark event in the history of the Jewish people. And a lot of the Talmud is about it in response to that. The people that put together the Mishnah are called the Tanaim, that's plural. Singular is Tana. Tana means teacher. And there were basically 6 generations of people. So there's hundreds and hundreds of names of teachers in the Talmud, not all of them rabbis, not all of them men, actually. And you can generally put them in a category of this is a third generation Tana, this is a fifth generation Tana. And that's how we know. Why is that important? Because they were teachers. So there were schools of thought like Hillel and Shammai, and the teaching got passed down. So there are traditions within groups. Now, after the Mishnah, I'm sorry, got closed, that's the technical word for it, meaning no more changes. even though historically that's not true either. Then the Gemara was written, and it turns out that this effort, there were two going on at the same time. So there was a, based on the same Mishnah, in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, the Talmud was compiled by five generations of scholars that we call Amoraim, plural. Singular is Amorah. And Amorah does not mean teacher, literally means speaker, like Amar. Did someone come in? Yes, someone came in. Sorry about that. Okay, so we're being joined, and that looks like Benna. Oh, she hasn't think. So there we go. So this was five generations, and in the year 400, it's called the Palestinian Talmud because it was in Palestine. It's also called the Yerushalmi or the Jerusalem Talmud. This was effectively closed in the year 400, meaning again, no changes were made at that point. In Babylonia, they worked on the Talmud for another 100 years. So there are eight generations of Amoraim in Babylon. And that Talmud was closed in the year 500. So the Babylonian Talmud is more comprehensive. It's better edited. It contains, both Talmuds are basically the same, the commentary is a little different. Scholars went back and forth between Israel and Babylonia. So rabbis appear in both volumes and they would bring traditions from one place to the other. But the Babylonian Talmud, for example, doesn't deal with the agriculture in the land of Palestine because it was removed. Whereas the Palestinian Talmud doesn't deal with a lot of legal material like torts and things like that. So that's the basic structure of what the Talmud is. Anybody want to ask a question on that? Nope, then we move along. So to what may this be compared? What is a good way to think about how these elements work? So there happens to be, I think, a very good analogy between the Jewish system of Torah, Mishnah, Gemara to the American system. So the American system is in 1776, the founding fathers produced the Declaration of Independence. So the Declaration is not a legal document. It's really a document about ideas. It's about founding principles, life, liberty, pursuit of justice. That's very analogous to the Mishnah. And the commentary on the Declaration, as you would imagine, is the Constitution, which looks into the Declaration for inspiration, for ideas, and produces a legal system out of that. And that's how it works. Okay. Now, vocabulary. So I've already said most of these things here, but again, I'm very big on words. You know, most of the words we have here, Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, Talmud, Tana, all mean teaching. Amorah is different, speaker. And really even learning is maybe more exact. And we will see, there's Hebrew and there's Aramaic. So Hebrew was the holy language in those days. We're talking again about the year zero. And Aramaic was the common language. It was the language that everybody spoke, pretty much like English today. So it's very analogous to what we do today, right? We read the Torah in Hebrew. Very few people in the congregation are able to translate that Hebrew. So we have English texts. And similarly, in those days, when they read the Torah, they didn't know the Hebrew that well either. And they would actually have a person there who would repeat the Hebrew verse in Aramaic. And that's how they would read Torah in those days. So Hebrew and Aramaic are cousins. And it's kind of like knowing French and reading Spanish. So some words look a lot alike, some words don't look at all alike. If you know one, you can kind of start to figure out the other. And that's how that works. And there are rules for going from one to the other. So for example, right? Everyone knows the word shana, like Rosh Hashanah. Shana means year. But what is the root of that word? Shana really means to repeat. So that's why Rosh Hashanah is head of the repeat, head of the year. Well, when you translate from Hebrew to Aramaic, the shin becomes a tav. So shana becomes tana. Tana means teacher. Why? A teacher is a person who repeats a lesson. And that's where we get the word from. Okay, so that's all I want to say. So again, the Gemara is mostly, it's about two-thirds Aramaic, one-third Hebrew. But it's like a legal document. So you see certain phrases over and over again, like in contracts, party of the first part, for example, that you learn to recognize that after a while. Okay, so given all that, that's the background. What do we want to accomplish in this section? So basically, we're going to go through the Talmud slowly. That's what the name La'at means, slow Talmud. The goal is to understand the arguments. Again, this will all be in English, except where there's a Hebrew word that is important and we need to delve in on it. And it's, what's the value of it to us as modern people? Well, first of all, you know, it's our cultural heritage. This is the basis of everything we do. You can almost make the argument that the Talmud, in a sec, is more affecting of our daily Jewish lives than is the Bible. It also will help us to learn critical thinking, because as you will see, everything in the Talmud is questions and answers. Why did you say this? Why didn't you say that? How can he agree with him? And so on. And you get to see kind of at the lowest level how the Talmud works, how it's put together. Something I find fascinating. I hope you do as well. All right. This is now the second introduction. So the Mishnah. There are six orders of the Mishnah. And I will say that if you put all the Mishnah together, it would be about the size of a hardcover book. If you put all the Talmud together, it's about the size of an encyclopedia. So that gives you an example of how expansive the Talmud is. There are traditionally six orders of the Mishnah, as they are called. These are general top-level categories. And they are called orders in English, Seder in Hebrew. And each order is composed of tractates, which are topic-specific books. Excuse me. We are in the order of Nezikin, which is damages, which consists of 10 tractates. The tractate in Hebrew is Masechet, plural is Masechtot. And these are mostly legal things. And you'll see from the chart that the first three tractates are Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Batra. Bava means gate. Kama is first, Metzia is middle, Batra is final. So these are three separate gates. And Bava Kama is largely devoted to what we call in English torts. So what is a tort? Unless I have this on my next slide. No, I don't have it on my next slide. So a tort is a legal action from one person to another. And I'm not a lawyer. Meaning, I steal something from you. Now, what happens in the modern world? In the modern world, the police come and arrest me and they try me, and there's a legal fiction, right? It's not you versus Steve Gross, the thief. It's the people of New Jersey, right? Which is an entity that's a fiction. And the punishment is you put me in jail, or you fine me, or you put me on probation. So they did have courts. It's a very important thing at courts in the ancient world. But what happened is if I stole from you in the ancient world, there was a tort. I then owed you something. I certainly owed you back your property that I had stolen. And then you get into kinds of issues of, what if I had damaged it? What if I had sold it to someone else? And that's a large part of what this tractate of Bava Kamma is about. So torts is the word here. I had written it down. Okay. Now, this is the part where I wanted to scare everyone. So this is an actual page of the Talmud as it was printed in Vilna in 1400, 1400. And I want to go through, as I said, this is the scary part, but it has its own structure, and I want to show you what we will do with this. So first of all, let me go back a second. There are things in the very outside columns. And on the right side, there are references to other places in the Talmud. Important concept, the Talmud is called the Sea of Talmud, Yam Talmud, because the conception is, the conceit is, you know all of Talmud starting out. So if you're in some place and you have a reference to somewhere else and you go there, the authors of the Talmud assume you know both things, even if they're all in not in one place, which of course you don't until you study all of it. So on the right is the apparatus for finding those references. On the left is a reference to the legal codes. So this will surprise you. The Talmud is not really a book of laws. The Talmud really does not give you the halakha in the end. It gives you the arguments. The halakha is decided elsewhere, not all the time, but most of the time. And that's what the things on the left are for. So let's get rid of them. So now you have the page without those things. And the page is comprised of basically four things, right? There's the middle section and there's the two sides. So here we're going to go through what is the page made of. We'll start on the top left. In the pink box, you see a bet. So the Talmud famously starts with one page of Talmud. I'm going to say this again. For those of you that know books, recto verso, a leaf of a Talmud, a page on both sides, is called a daf. And it has an amud, or a page one and a page two, right, both sides of it, which are called A and B. And the Talmud always starts with page B, 2B, because the tradition is you want to feel like as soon as you start, you're immersed in Talmud, so you didn't get to page one in the introduction. So that's how you refer to a page in Talmud, as daf aleph or daf bet, with a number. Next over in the green box is Bava Kamma. That is the name of the tractate. In the middle is Perek Rishon. Perek means chapter. So it's chapter one. And finally on the right.
Funny, you can hear that.
There
voice
is.
Right down. Yeah, which
I'm sorry, who's talking?
Where Mark was coming from.
Were you right?
Hello? There? I think that's Benna. On the right, you see Arba'a Avot in a purple box. So those are the first two words of the Mishnah. The way you refer to books in Judaism in the ancient world is by the first two words of the opening chapter. So it would be like, instead of calling the book Moby Dick, we would call the book Call Me Ishmael. That's how it works. So if someone came to you and said, what perek, what chapter of Talmud are you learning? The answer would not be chapter one. The answer would be Arba'a Avot. Now, let's go to the red box in the middle. So this is the Talmud itself. The thing in the red box is the Mishnah, which we will talk about for the rest of the evening. But I just wanted you to see the size of the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is in Hebrew. And if you can read, you see the Arba'a is embroidered, it's fancy, and then Avot. That's the opening words of the Mishnah. Even though it's all written in Hebrew letters, what follows, and I have a blue circle if you can see it, it's not the easiest, that says Gimel Mem, that means Gemara. Gemara starts here. And what we are going to do in this class is just go through this piece at a time and stop and explain and punctuate it and translate it. Now, one more thing about the page here that I want to tell you for tradition's sake. So there's always two columns in the Talmud on every page. And on the binding side is always, when you see the red purple letter R, is Rashi. Rashi is a 11th century French scholar. And he commented on the entire Talmud. And it's a running commentary. And it's easy to say that if not for Rashi, we would probably not be able to read the Talmud today. Because what he does is very, very simple. He just will stop and explain words or put in a missing word, because the Talmud is very terse. It's very compact. And we will refer at times in English again to Rashi's comment about what something means. On the left side, marked by the blue T, are the Tosafot. So this is a French school of Talmudists who are Rashi's grandsons and others. And they are more tech, we will not see the most much of them. They're very technical, they're very scholarly. What their goal is to make you think the Talmud is a unified work everywhere, and all the pieces fit together and there's no contradictions and so on. So that is the page of the Talmud. Any questions on this? No questions. So with that, we're going to start with the Mishnah. And let me just peek ahead for a second. Okay. So this is the first Mishnah. This is the stuff in the red box here, written out in Hebrew. And I'll read it to you in English. There are four primary causes of injury. So injury, damages, that's our topic. The ox, the pit, the maveh, and the fire. The ox is not like the crop-destroying beast, and the crop-destroying beast is not like the ox. Nor is either of these which are alive like fire, which is not alive. Nor is any of these whose way is to go forth and do injury like the pit, whose way it is not to go forth and do injury. What they have in common is that it is their way to do injury. You are responsible for watching over them. And if one of them does injury, whoever is responsible for the injury must make restitution with the best of his land. And I'm sure that's clear. You're ready to take a test on it and understand what's going on here. So everything here is supposed to stimulate you to ask questions. So let's go back to the very first sentence. And okay. There are four primary causes of injury. Arba'a avot nizikin. Avot is a word, arba'a is four. Avot you might know as pirkei avot. Avot means father. Abba is the same word. So avot here means a primary cause of injury, and we'll talk some more about that. And again, they're listed in Hebrew, the ox, the pit, the maveh, and the fire. So now I'm going to bring in Rashi. So this is typical. So Rashi comments, and he's doing it on words at a time. So arba'a avot. Why are they called avot, which we now know means primary categories? Because they are written in the Torah explicitly.
Steve, what is a maveh?
I'm glad you asked that, Judy. Get there in 1 second.
Okay,
next question. Why these four things in this order? And according to Rashi, because that is the order they occur in the Torah, when the Torah discusses these things, and we will see these verses. So that explains that. But see, that's a question you might not have thought to ask. You know, why this order? Then Rashi says, what's a maveh? So you can go home satisfied tonight, Judy, because you asked the same question Rashi asked, which is, what does maveh mean? Because it turns out it's a problematic word and we don't know quite sure. And the Talmud will actually spend like two whole pages discussing this. So that's where we start with. And finally, what does the word hever mean? So again, it's not all that clear, because we have a verse that says when a fire is started, and he uses that word, we'll see the verse, but it's not the normal word. It's not the Torah word for fire. Actually, I take that back. It is the Torah word for fire. So these are Rashi's comments to start us off. Now, when you learn Talmud in a slow way, as I did, one of the rules is the Talmud is filled with proof, what are called proof texts from the Torah, verses from the Torah. And the conceit of the Mishnah is that everything in the Mishnah has an anchor, has a verse in the Torah that supports it, even though that's not always the case. And the second thing is there are a lot of people, a lot of rabbis, sages in the Talmud. And the lesson I learned was whenever you see a proof text, you look it up, because some of the text is quoted, but it's often the part of the text that is not quoted, because the rabbis assume you know the entire Torah by heart, that tells you something important. And similarly, when you see the name of a sage, you look the sage up and find out what generation they were they in Israel or Babylon, etc. So with that, we have the four things now, the ox, the pit, the maveh, and the fire. And we're going to look at the verses in the Torah that describe them. So these are now straight out of the Torah, and this is the ox. So if a man's ox hurts another's so that it dies, in other words, an ox gores another ox, the famous ox that gored, they sell the live ox, they divide the price of it, and the dead they also divide. So if my ox gores David's ox to death, we get together, we sell my bad ox and get the money for it. We sell the carcass of the dead ox to the butcher, and David and I split all that money. That's what the Torah says. However, if it is known the ox was wont to gore in the past and the owner hasn't kept it in, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead beast shall be his own. Meaning, and we cover this again at length. So this is now you get into kind of the English phrase of Talmudic or hair splitting differences. So the sages recognize there are two kinds of ox. There's an ox that is known to be dangerous, like beware of dog, beware of ox. And there's an ox that has never hurt anybody before. And they are called Tom, which means innocent, and Muad, which means dangerous. These are roughly things. And what the verse here is telling you, when they say the ox was wont to gore, so this means you own the dangerous ox. You own the beware of dog. And if you own that ox, you have a higher level responsibility to guard it, because you know it's going to cause a problem. And if it does cause a problem, in the previous example, the ox you didn't know is dangerous, then you only paid half damages. But if you know it's a dangerous ox, you are completely responsible and you pay full damages. And that's what the other part of this verse is. And again, the Talmud will go into this in great detail. So that's the ox. Next is the pit. So if a man opens a pit, or he digs a pit and he doesn't cover it, and an animal falls into it, then the owner of the pit owes damages. He has to give the money to whoever owns those animals, but he gets to keep the carcass again. And that's the basic rule of the pit. Now comes the maveh. So we have this verse again in Exodus 22, that if a man causes a field or a vineyard to be eaten, now notice it's not, you know, as you both know, as regular goers, as you all know, right? The Torah is not always very clear about the subject, object of the verses. So if a man causes a field or vineyard, not that the man goes out and eats the field, but the man's cow wanders out and eats the field, his neighbor's field. then he has to make restitution from the best of his field. That's the basic thing. But what you see here is the word maveh, which is a strange Hebrew word. And if you look in this text, you see the word be'iro or be'er. The English here has translated that as a beast that eats crops, or what I called originally a crop-destroying animal. And that's, Judy, where it comes from. And finally, fire. And we have another verse for fire. And you will notice, by the way, well, I'll just do this verse. So if a fire breaks out and it consumes a field, if you started the fire, you have to make restitution. Yeah. And here, first of all, I want to point out that the word is esh in Hebrew, which is the modern day Hebrew word for fire. The other thing I want to show you is, right, Rashi's question about why this order. So if we go back to the verses, we have Exodus 21:35, then 21:33. And I know you'll say, Steve, that's out of order, because 35 comes before 33, but it turns out that the verse is actually there. Then 22:4, and finally 22:5. So that is the order of the verses. And now we come back to the original text. So this was the first sentence. This was the first sentence of the Mishnah. And now, hopefully, we understand what it says. Four cases of injury. So now the Mishnah is going to, this is the same Mishnah we started with 1-1. Now I'm breaking it down by sentences. And what I want to show you here is two things, first of all. So the Mishnah was oral, right? It's called the Oral Torah. And it was transmitted orally. And a lot of study has done, right? Basically, nobody was writing things down until this time, the time of the Mishnah. And these traditions were oral, and they were passed down orally. And you can actually look in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, and in the Gemara, because that was also oral, and see the rhythms of the words and see how people remembered it. So if you look at the blue, there's the sentence in black on the top, but if you look at the blue, you see the similarities between the two sentences, and it helps you recognize it. And you can see that the words shor and maveh are basically just swapped between the two sentences.
When was it written down?
I'm sorry, David?
When was it written down?
So this was written down. It was finished by being written down by the year 200. But oral traditions really went on probably for another 1,000 years. It's a very hot academic topic. So there's a question. Forgive me, I have to go. I want to go back and just see what I have so I don't repeat myself. No, I have this all. Okay. So we're not going to deal with it tonight because we're almost done here, and this is the introductory. But the question might, you might ask this question. Why are there four categories? Right? I want to go back to that sentence for a moment. I want to ask two questions on this. So first of all, why does the Torah, or why does the Talmud, better, need to put down four categories of damagers? Couldn't there have been a law that says, you know, if I damage you, I have to pay back what I damaged, right? It could be that simple. Instead, we have these four categories of damages. And the other question is, we've talked about now avot, meaning primary causes. And I expand on this in the next class or two, but if you have primary categories, doesn't that by logic seem to imply you have secondary categories? And it turns out you do, lots of them. So these are representative categories of things. And the Gemara is going to start off by asking, why do we have these four different categories? I should say that the Mishnah is already doing that. So it's telling you the ox and the crop-destroying beast, or the mavev, now if you want to call it that way, why aren't they one thing? And always you want to ask the questions, what do they have in common, but what do they not have in common? So the simple answer here is, what do they have in common? Is these are two things that are alive. They're animals. And no, I'll just leave it that way. So they are alive, but in what way are they different? Then, so the Mishnah answers that question. And again, in blue, you can see the structure of the sentence, that they have ruach chayim, literally the breath of life. So ox and mave are alive, they're animals, but fire is not alive. So that's why we need a distinctive category for fire. Okay, then what about pit? Well, all three of the first things, the ox, the mave, and the fire, they move. They're movable things. They move and they cause damage in their movement. But a pit doesn't move. It's stationary. So it's almost like a kid's riddle. How is a pit not like an ox? An ox moves, a pit does not. But what do all four of these categories, and I think this is the last slide, have in common? And the answer is a couple things. That it is in their way, meaning it is in the nature of these things that they cause damage. Fire causes damage, right? We all know that. You know, I keep saying a bad dog, but an ox that gores is going to cause damage. Or if you leave the gate open, it's going to get out and trample on things. So they have that in common. The other thing they have in common is you're responsible, right? We don't hold an ox guilty if it eats its field. We don't hold a fire guilty. We hold the owner of the ox. We hold the person who creates the fire guilty. So that's the second thing they have in common. And the third thing they have in common is, if any of them did injury, you have to pay up. You are responsible for the damage that they cause. So that is the end of the text here, the introductory text. I just want to say, so the Talmud's going to go on to say that everything has a unique characteristic. And the other thing I want to point out to you also is that you get a flavor of this. The Mishnah is based on the Torah, but it's also independent of the Torah, right? Reading that, you wouldn't necessarily know that there are proof texts for what it's claiming. And in fact, sometimes there isn't. So it explains the Torah, but it can usually, the Mishnah, be understood on its own. And with that, we come to an end of this.
And I hope this very nice and very interesting. Steve, one of the major forces that causes torts is people. And I'm wondering, it's not among those four avot. The Mishnah will discuss or not discuss the role of people being responsible for committing a tort against another.
So you see, it's working. You're already thinking Talmudically. As it turns out, they will expand people as a category of damager, and people is in its own category. Shares have things in common, it doesn't. And the sections we have just been dealing with recently, we have two rabbis. One comes along and says, no, there are really 13 categories of damagers. And then another one comes along and says, no, there are really 24 categories of damagers. And a lot of time is spent saying, given that we call this thing a damager, can we derive that this thing would be a damage? So yes, and people is definitely one of those categories, and the Talmud deals with that all on its own.
And there are, I mean, it would be fun to go through and guess what the 13 or the 26 are. Trees are a source of damage. I mean, many, many things are sources of damage, potentially sources of damage.
You're right, but also you have to be careful about the thing about people being responsible for them.
Right.
Right. If there is a great wind, let's say, that blows down your fence and then your ox gets out and eats, you're not liable for that because it's an act of God.
Unless the fence was not in pristine condition, or unless you knew that the fence might blow out. There are many, many, you know,
yes.
It's all, you know, super interesting and, you know, many different ways to think about it.
It's definitely true. And I do almost a whole session on the 13 and the 24 categories. It's not things
that'll be very interesting.
You would necessarily think. It is online if you want to go look it up, or I can, you know, talk to you about it one-on-one if you want, but it's all in there.
Well, this was very nice, and thank you for arranging it and showing